I'm not happy. I think I need a move. This isn't working for me. Seeing my wife pregnant and thinking, I don't want to be a miserable dad.
So what did you say to your wife on that holiday?
Going through pivotal moments in life where we had to ask, is it really worth it? To finding a fusion between humans and machines to create a smart and effective service.
That is the most important thing, to have a business where contribution is recognised, rewarded and celebrated. What AI does, it enables you to free your creative teams up to have more thinking time, challenge it more, craft it more. That's where the value comes. Anything's possible. Do the right things, think big. If you're passionate about what you do, you tend to do it better and then you tend to be more successful.
Greetings, I'm Ashley Samuels McKenzie.
And I'm Charles Parkinson.
And welcome to How I Became,
where we unveil the unscripted journeys of inspirational figures.
If you enjoy the show, could you do one thing? Subscribe. Wherever you are, just click the subscribe or follow button. That simple act can help us grow the podcast in a big way, and we need your support to do it. And if you really want to help play a part in our growth, rate us on Spotify or leave a review on Apple Podcasts. It would mean the world. Thank you. This episode is brought to you by Uber, shaping the future for consumers as they go anywhere and get anything. Advertising on Uber connects brands with hundreds of millions of people using Uber around the world in the moments that move them most. To learn more about what we can do for your brand, visit uber.com/advertising.
I'm Matt Kiddy, and this is how I became CEO and founder of the Amigo Partnership.
Born into a family of engineers, who would have thought he would choose a career in creative? Seeing truth in the right people make the right culture, a value that holds true and native. Understanding your own value can ensure you never sell yourself short, and he shows you can be part of a winning team, despite not pursuing his early career in sport. Going through pivotal moments in life where we had to ask, is it really worth it? To finding a fusion between humans and machines to create a smart and effective service. We'll strip back and get to the heart of it. Introducing Matt Kiddy, CEO and founder of the Amigo Partnership.
Thank you.
There we go.
No one's ever written a poem for me. I don't know whether blush or give you a kiss.
Either's fine.
It is often a first for people on the show to get a poem written for them. And so that is your life as a poem. And in this episode, we're going to share the story of how you became founder and CEO of the Amigo Partnership, which is a great story. And I think it's so good for anybody who's either currently a business owner, entrepreneur, or an aspiring one, because you've done something that is seen as the sort of the big milestone thing to achieve as an entrepreneur. One, you've set up your own companies with your co-founder. But two, you've sold your company, which is a lot of what people, entrepreneurs set out to do, is to build it, get it to the right place and sell it. And the issue is, when you did that, it was a very difficult time and you weren't very happy when you did. So that is what we're going to explore, is how to what lessons you learned from doing that. And anybody who is, running a business and looking to sell one day, I think you're an amazing person to listen to on how to do it well, how to do it right, and how not to do it as well. So that's what's to come. But I'll hand over to Ash for kicking things off.
So how to be an entrepreneur? Well, is an entrepreneur born? Or are they formed from people that they see and things they hear about?
How was it for you?
I think I got my entrepreneurialism through a number of factors, influence of people. So as you just said, grew up in, the influences of, engineers, so engineering family.
So they weren't entrepreneurs, they were engineers.
Well, they were good point. No, my dad was certainly, so my uncle and my father were definitely entrepreneurs because they had their own businesses.
Okay. What were they? What were the businesses?
So they were they engineered component parts for sports cars, Formula One, touring cars, etc. We talked about AMG earlier, but they did a lot of work for Brabus.
And those small teams as well. Anyway, F1 fans here, Williams F1 in peak Williams era as well, with Who was
Nigel Mansell. Nigel Mansell, when he won his championship, at least one of them, is in Damon Hill's car as well, when at Williams. He worked with, I think, Schumacher in when he was in the Jordan Hart, and definitely Eddie Irvine when he was in Jordan Hart as well. So, yeah, so that was my dad. So he had a really interesting career. You know, I used to work in, you know, for him as well, you know, in school holidays and things like that. You know, loved it. But, you know, it's kind of his influence, I guess, taught me work ethic and, you know, the entrepreneurial, you can do it, you can achieve it. You just, you know, set your goals, go do it.
So you, essentially, you saw your dad running his own business, and that became an option, I guess.
Well, I think it normalized it. I think I don't think there was ever a moment where I, you know, thought, I want to do that like you've done it, Dad. But I think it made it achievable that, you know, that normal people can, you know, set up businesses and be successful. Mm. You know, big influence was one of my father's friends, a guy called Jonathan Crisp, who he was very different, you know, in terms of the way he was as a person. He started an agency, ran an agency called Marketing Solutions back in the day, sold it out to Omnicom, was very, very successful.
For anybody not in the world of advertising, when you say agency, it was a creative advertising
agency? Exactly, a creative agency. So, you know, they would do advertising, marketing campaigns that, you know, were broader than just advertising. You know, really successful, very interesting guy, had a different view of the world. Was very different to my upbringing, you know, in the Midlands. It's, you know, surrounded by kind of engineers, if you like. But, you know, they associated also with, you know, very different people. But he was just like quite an very inspirational figure, because it was like he had a different view. And that was a catalyst for me. Well, it sparked my curiosity to go, you know, how did you become you? And that's cool. I want to do that. Mm. And you know, my mother was amazing as well. She's like, actually, you know, go do what you need to do rather than going down the, I guess, natural path. But yeah, no, it's amazing. So he, you know, was very fortunate. He was very close, you know, back then when I was growing up. I was doing a degree and stuff, and in my sandwich year, he got me a job working in an ad agency in Melbourne, in Australia, working on the Coca-Cola account and Mars Confectionery of Australia, New Zealand and China account. And I loved it. You know, this is a great world where you're dealing with creativity, you know, working on amazing brands, for me, new cultures, you know, coming from the UK. So it's just brilliant. That's where I got the bug.
It was this chap in London. Sorry, what was his name?
Jonathan Crisp.
Jonathan Crisp.
Yeah.
He was the one who got you this job in Australia, and really, yeah, inspired you that you didn't have to be an entrepreneur or a business owner in the world of engineering. Although it would be pretty cool if you were working for Red Bull or Mercedes now.
It would.
It sparked your fascination by this world of advertising and marketing and creative and agencies, which we should say, we'll get into what is Amigo Partnership in more detail later, but just briefly, what is Amigo Partnership for people who don't know?
So Amigo Partnership is a creative agency. We're independent. We deliver brand, strategy, creative, and predominantly digital solutions for an array of clients.
Big brands, we should
say
that.
Yeah.
Can you name drop a few?
Yeah. So we work with the likes of Rio Tinto, QBE, Laurent Perrier, Live School Media, Virgin Middle East and Africa, and numerous others. Sorry if I've missed any out that are really important.
It's a bit of a tricky question to ask. It's like asking someone to add
UNICEF.
There we go.
Nice.
Yeah. And that's something we're going to go into later, is how to win big blue chip clients as well, and how you've done that and what's been successful. But we'll get to that. For now, your career, we kind of fast track through your career. You didn't go straight into starting a company. You went to Australia, came back to London, and you worked at a couple of independent agencies. You worked at a big, what we call network agency, which is part of a larger group, Ogilvy. Are you thinking at that point, I'm going to start my own agency one day? And Well, let's just start there. Is that what you're thinking going through your career at this point?
Yes, I mean, going over, for instance, going to Australia for the first time was amazing. Melbourne is such a good city. You know, I had a bit of an epiphany there on, you know, what life could be, and, you know, wanted to be more curious about traveling the world and whatnot. But I was also, just going back a step before going forward, not natural, you know, into coming into this industry or into the creative industry, because you know, my kind of education was quite traditional, wasn't particularly creative, you know, all that kind of stuff, you know, the classic did art, did this, and I didn't, you know, I chased a ball around. And then
rugby, you almost became a professional rugby player.
Yeah,
well, I wasn't, yeah, nearly yeah. I
mean, you got pretty high pretty, level,
yeah, but reality is not good enough. But the but then coming back, so to finish the degree, came into London, got a job at an independent agency called Brewer Blackler, working on advertising for what was called then 1-to-1. It's now T-Mobile, then morphed into EE.
Yeah.
So that was really cool. And then got a job, moved around a bit, but went to Ogilvy, worked on a premium TV account, which was all the football, basically the Football League, the Scottish Football League, how they consolidated all their websites. They had independent websites by football brand, but created a media channel. So that was cool. Mm. Really enjoyed that. And, you know, worked, met some really cool people. And, you know, at that point, the conversation had been had around, oh, you know, we could do this. And, you know, this was, I guess, about 5 years into, into the career.
Then so came, you're what age at this point?
I guess about 25-ish, 26. Yeah, maybe 26. So, and then...
But you and colleagues are going, we could do this, we could do our own agency.
Or... Well, it's more the kind of, the classic, you know... down the pub with a couple of, you know, guys, and what you tend to do is you want to kind of perfect the process of delivery, right? And you kind of sometimes get frustrated, you know, when there's randomness in the process, or you don't think it's quite good as it should be. And then I think it's human nature to have those conversations, and you'd want to challenge it, and, you know, want to put your mark on it, and, you know, and want to do a better job, right? So
we can do better than Ogilvy. It's what you're saying.
Well, it sounds really arrogant, but
a lot of people
like that,
do think that. Yeah, when you're in a company, you see all the faults and you think, I could do this.
But you do get frustrated, you know, and sometimes when, particularly if you're working in a big machine, there's bureaucracy there that you don't necessarily need. And you sometimes feel, particularly when you're, you know, slightly impetuous, that you're taking a step back rather than going forward, you know, and all that kind of stuff. So... but then came out of there, and there was a breakaway that set up an independent called Grasshopper. That was great. I was kind of the third person in, not a founder. And, you know, went in as an account director, and that agency, you know, grew, blossomed, was fantastic. Then, you know, worked up to being on the board quite early, as in young. Amazing founder, CEO of that business that, you know, it taught me a lot, actually, when I look back retrospectively, a guy called Hugh Taylor, and being part of that and understanding how an agency actually grows, you know, the pitfalls, the challenges, you know, but the, you know, relentless kind of ambition to do it for all the various reasons, how to build teams, you know, whether that be client service, creative teams, how they should work together. And exist together and do amazing work. So that was, you could see it on the inside and be part of it. And then I guess that with the fused kind of childhood of, dad can do it, this can happen. Mm-hmm. Conversations, you know, in the middle, you know, down the pub with Paul Harrison, my partner. And then, you know, then there was a junction in life when we thought, you know what, this is the right time.
What's it like at that moment? And because there may be people listening who are having those chats down the pub.
Yeah.
What's the real experience? It's not like, oh yeah, we'll just go and set this up tomorrow. Are you feeling nervous? Is there trepidation? Are you concerned about things when you're thinking about going out on your own?
All those things. I mean, in my time of life, it was different for me than it was for Paul. He'd just had a child. And there's a pivot point we'll talk about, you know, when I just had a child, but he'd just had, I think, his first kid, and went, yeah, great idea, yeah, let's do that. And you go, are you mad? You know, because you're trying to build security into your life, right? And he was working for a big network, but, you know, things are happening there, and things are happening where I was, a grasshopper, and it was, you know, we just needed to, you know, it was the right point in time when we had the right kind of mindset and the right ambitions, but I had far less to lose, you know, in terms of that kind of, you know, the collateral damage that could have been, you know, if you had failure, because he's got to support, you know, his young family. So
yeah. How did you set yourself up for success?
I think it's kind of really, really following your passion, right? We set a target, and that was to create an agency and do things the way we wanted to do them. And we had a, you know, belief about bringing the best teams in place, being agile, et cetera, et cetera. We were very lucky, because at the same time as we had this urge to do our own thing, there was a need within a network called Momentum. It's a big agency, Part McCann. We had the opportunity to go in there, kind of incubate our baby.
How did that happen? So if someone listening to this and going, that sounds like a good plan, I'd like to get incubated. How did you actually orchestrate that to happen?
It was complete accident, you know. So we'd done a bit of work, we'd done some integrated work with Momentum, where they didn't have any digital specialization and wanted to go at this point in time.
So you did some work with them as your company, or
as Grasshopper?
I see.
Yeah. So we did an integrated piece. We pitched for a big piece of work for Boots, and it went really well. And then we did a few other kind of bits, you know, for Intel globally, or this and the other. So I'd got quite a bit of credibility over there that, you know, knew what I was on about. This, you know, from that kind of digital capability perspective. And I was speaking to who's now a great friend of mine, Alan Cobb, at the time, and saying, look, I'm not really happy doing this, and I've got this urge to, you know, set up a business with Paul, partner. And he then pathwayed us to go, right, if you're going to do that, we want you on the inside of here, because you can help us while you do your thing. Which is really
good. Who was this person, sorry?
A guy called Alan Cobb, great guy.
And he was your boss? He was a
counterpart. So I used to work with Al. Well, I met Al when he was senior at Momentum at the time, went on to run it, and then, you know, be senior McCann stuff. He pathwayed. There's a guy running it at the time called John Armstrong, sadly passed away, great guy. And he'd pathwayed it with John to say, look, we need this central specialization. Because they were quite a fragmented business in terms of back then, that just bought a few shops, merged them together, had you'd kind of fragmented yet complementary disciplines across retail, sponsorship, field marketing, and something else I can't remember right now. Yeah. But and what they were doing at the time is they were kind of adding on digital as part of their service offering, but it was all, again, didn't have a central kind of point of view in terms of being strategic. It was more tactical. And then they were, you know, on a commercial basis, they didn't have any kind of economies of scale coming out one central point. So, you know, we went in and did that.
So would you recommend that for someone who likes the idea of sort of setting up as an incubation, to have a chat with someone in the organization saying, look, I'm not really happy doing what I'm doing, but I do want to start a business, and just exploring whether there's options to do something like you've done?
I definitely think so. I mean, you've got to choose who you're going to speak to. You know, retrospectively, you know, actually going and speaking to, you know, McCann business is probably not a natural way to go about things, but it was just very fortuitous that new influential people there, and the timing was perfect. So for us, it was potentially lucky rather than designed.
Yeah.
But there is I think, you know, this is self-reference, but if a team came to us and said, look, we offer this value, we're different to what you offer service offering wise, can you bolt us in? You know, our future probably is elsewhere, but you never know. I think I'd be all over that to go, yeah, new talent, new views, new capability. If you can bolt that into your, you know, into your service offering to add, you know, additional value to your client base, then it, I think it's a bit of a no-brainer.
Mm. Okay. And how do you start a company? Someone's listening, they say, cool, right, I'm gonna be inspired by Matt and I'm going to start my company. How do you do it?
Yeah, have a dream, a passion, whatever you want to call it. Be clear about your value proposition and so why you're going to be different. Try and define your purpose as part of that as well and connect it to what the buyer will buy, clients, what are they interested to. Understand obviously the competitive landscape and you know where and how you're going to differentiate yourself because no one wants the same as everything else. Mm. And then go for it, you know, but really, you know, just be clear about what you're trying to achieve and be clear why that's going to be different, why that's going to be, you know, kind of listened to. Because the hardest thing is to just get through the door, you know, of clients. But clients want an edge all the time. So just be really clear about that, what that edge is, and then go after it.
Mm. So that's what you did, I guess. You had those conversations, you set your vision, you set your unique proposition, you got set up, incubated within the organization. What happened next on in the story?
So we were quite successful there in terms of growing revenue for that business. And at the time, we'd won a few of our own clients and started building a team. And then they out of the US, they bought a digital shop to bolt in and add scale, as networks do. So we said, okay, guys, that's done then. But in a nice way, it was really positive. And they helped us, and we continued doing some work for them as well. So, you know, you could prop up some of the costs, obviously, revenues required. And then we got our own space in Farringdon, a big leap of faith. You know, kind of a few sleepless nights when you're taking on a load of overhead directly.
Talk to us about that, because I think this is the thing that stops a lot of people, because it's that fear of responsibility and the unknown that often people don't make that transition to actually go out and start alone. How did you get over that?
At the time, I think I was just headstrong. You know, this was a long time ago now, like Agency One. And yeah, I was just determined, you know, didn't even think about it. We're doing that.
What would you say to someone who's saying, like, oh, I'm interested in starting one, but, you know, what about all the costs? Like, yeah, we've got to pay for an office and we've got to hire staff. And what if we don't bring the money in and I've got a kid as well and all these things? What would you say?
Be good at maths. So I think you've got to be a calculated risk taker. So don't do anything that is too high risk. Understand, you know, the risk spectrum. You know, you've got to offset that with obviously your drive, your passion, you know, and where you think is right for a business to launch. And then you've just got to be quite pragmatic about it and go, you know, what is the right time to take on cost? It is always, you know, in terms of growing a business, the biggest your handbrake that, you know, there is a natural kind of fear of going too far with your cost base, because you can't sometimes, particularly when your agency is or business is new, because you've got no pipeline visibility. So it's you're taking incremental leaps of faith. And then because you're small and you're hands-on, you know, as a team, then you're operating in kind of peaks and troughs, because, you know, when you win the work, you're doing the work, then you deliver the work and go, where's the next work? And then you go, business development to get the next work, then you do the work and you go, oh, where are we? And then so then you've got to go from that into kind of that. And that means then taking the step back, scaling up, so you're not always hands-on, and you then are looking at, you know, being on the business, not being in the business, and then looking at, you know, pipeline delivery.
And that is the classic thing, that roller coaster of, we know from experience, you get busy with the work, you do the work, nobody's doing new business, you're not going out to events, you're not meeting people, you're not doing outbound, and suddenly, oh, where's the money going to be coming? You have to go and do that. Is that just an inevitable path at the beginning, you think, just you need to go through, or is there ways to avoid going through that? Should you avoid going through that?
Okay, survey one, or two, actually, because you've been through the same thing. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, hindsight, you've got to have some discipline to step off a bit and not do, you know, always be in the work and be doing the work, because you've got to be horizon planning, you know, from a business development perspective, from a scaling perspective, from a, you know, meeting talent, you know, when they can be onboarded and all that kind of stuff. So that, you know, that requires a bit of discipline, because, you know, you're pulled into, you know, doing the work, particularly if you want to keep the overhead down. So it's a difficult balance, but at some point you've got to take the leaps of faith to move the business forward, because there are certain, you know, difficult points. One is, you know, launching the business, because then you've got the trepidation of, you know, taking that leap, you know, for Paul and I, and you know, that was quite a, you know, difficult, a lot of difficult decisions for him, difficult decisions for me, because coming away from the security of a permanent job, and then obviously fear of failure and stuff, but you just go, and then you're determined. So that's, you know, a really difficult part. Then the next one is, you know, as you said, as we're talking about now, is like when you do start getting the projects in, the clients in, you're winning, it's then you've got to make sure that you're servicing them right, you're delivering quality, but you're looking for the next job. And then it's all about kind of extending pipeline and visibility, so you are making the business as sustainable as possible, you know, for the short, medium and long term.
And what were some of the best ways that you used to increase that pipeline and gain more clients?
Networking. Mm-hmm. So I think it's as basic as keeping in touch with clients when you're working with them in whatever prior to or during, doing the best job you can, earning trust, being someone and a service they can lean on. Try and be as frictionless as possible, as in an enabler, not a, you know, part of the problem, you're a solution. And then build relationships. I personally think that is the key thing, you know, particularly in, yeah, we do quite a lot of new business development now. We're pitching a lot at the moment, but the premise is exactly the same, in that you land it, you deliver quality work, you stay in your swim lane, you do the job, you excel at the job, and then you start talking about potentially other things based on a foundation of credibility and results.
Any tips for how you would network, and any advice there?
I think just be accessible as possible, you know, try and, you know, walk the floors as much as you can, you know, in terms of, we're in a different world now where, you know, meetings aren't as prevalent, you know, in terms of, back in the day, I'd always try and be in the client's office, you know, talking to people, making, you know, connections. And you never know when that can spark a conversation about a problem they've got, a challenge that's quite, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And then that's the perfect opportunity to then, you know, offer a solution to that, or point of view on it, build your credibility, or give a response, sort of stroke proposal. You know, we live in a world now where meetings are less frequent, as in, you know, because, you know, a lot of people are hybrid, and obviously team Zooms, whatever, is prevalent as well. So, but yeah, it's just about keeping relationships, you know, going.
So we're not talking about the Amigo partnership here. We're talking about your first business, and you obviously do very well, because you get to this position, as I mentioned earlier, where you're ready to sell the business, which is a milestone, as I said, a lot of people would love to achieve and set out to. Tell us the story of how that unfolds. How you even, were you looking for someone to buy it? How you found them? Do you go to the local corner shop and put a little image in the corner shop window saying agency for sale?
Well, sure, some agencies have been sold.
That's what I'll do next. Good idea.
It's quite creative. Yeah.
Like old school. So again, factors of circumstance, I guess. So, you know, we'd done a good job of, you know, scaling the business to a certain level. We'd met a guy called Jamie Parker, who then, you know, he became part of us, and we had this agency called Coda Digital. We're doing amazing work for some amazing clients, you know, doing a lot of digital advertising work for Financial Times, Eurosport, Discovery Channel, Puma, and more, LG Mobile, etc. And, you know, we're doing a fantastic job. So we'd gone into, there was a kind of opportunity to go into a boutique network at the time called The Contact Group, and that was founded by a guy called Ian Sanderson, who had very successfully built an agency, you know, back in the day called Dynamo. And Ian had come up with this kind of idea, you know, with the other founders of the group, whereby you could plug in agency discipline specialisms. So you've got, you know, sponsorship, you've got retail, you've got experiential, you've got digital, you've got print, I think that was and you've got DM, and you've got promotion. So we had the opportunity to go in there as a digital agency, and the premise was, if you get, you know, so an agency is valued on its, yeah, various things, but, you know, in a crude sense, on its revenue and EBIT. So what's it driving from a gross revenue perspective, and then you've got your operating profit or EBITDA, and then off the back of that you have a multiple, you know, so you'd be valued on a multiple of whatever that number may be, based on other factors like, you know, what's been bought in the market, how strong is your management team, what's the structure of your client base, what's your point of difference, blah blah blah. And then,
so these are all the things that they're looking for when they're looking to buy an agency or a company.
Yeah, in simplistic terms, yeah. So, but the why I'm saying that is because then if you put together a network, a boutique network, where you've got, because a lot of it's about critical mass, if you take one component, one agency, the multiplier could be lower. Yeah, so the valuation, and offer smaller number of valuation, lower.
What's the average multiplier for an individual?
So right now it's probably about 6-7, I think. Okay. It really depends. Depends where you are, you know, on the, you know, how big you are, what's your point of difference, etc. But going back to the Contact Group, there, the rationale there was to have, if you've got, you can build critical mass by plugging together complementary agencies. You can offer a service to bigger clients because you've got a integrated service offering. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then on a business level, you can increase your multiplier because you've got more of a unique proposition and you've got more critical mass. Mm. So it makes sense on an individual level as well as on a group level. Does that make sense?
It does, yeah. And what's the difference? So if it's 6 or 7, if you're an individual agency, what would it be as a group on average?
It's hypothetically, it could be 8 or 9. You know, okay. There's no... Yeah, in any given time, you have to look at what's happening in the market, what are the market conditions, and how unique, you know, you are, how, you know, what your client base, you know, is, how's that contracted, you know, retainer versus project, what your historic trading performance has been, what does that look like from a projection perspective, what's your management team like? You know, there's a lot of different lenses that need to be put on it. So it's very difficult to say it's A or B, you know, there's many factors.
And can we just put some numbers as an example? So give us an example of an EBITDA and the multiples, and then what that means, just breaking it down really simply.
So if you've got in really easy mathematical sense, so if you are running a business of 1 million gross profit, you should be around 22%, 28% ish margin, therefore you're going to get, let's call it £220,000 of EBITDA. Then say you get a multiple.
And anyone who's confused about EBITDA, what is that? To explain,
that is it is earnings before interest, tax, and something else. But it's basically profit before tax.
Yeah. Mm. Okay. So yeah, carry on the calculation.
And then you times that by your multiplier. So you've got, let's call it 200 because that's easier for my terrible maths. Times 5 equals it'd be worth £1 million.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
If the multiplier was 5. So that's how it works. How we got down this rabbit hole, I don't know. So I'm sorry about that.
It's good. Basically, this is a breakdown for anybody who's interested in selling their company one day, or even they're starting their company. It's just, I think really what this is helpful for is yet to sell. They just want to learn from your journey and experience of doing it. So this is helpful in that way. Yeah.
And we're going through this now at the moment, actually. So in terms of, you know, where we need to look at our business, it's not just about, you know, growth, driving numbers, you know, actually. And this is a bit of advice, actually. Don't be transactional. Be value and quality driven. Be really passionate about what you're trying to achieve and do great work. The numbers will look after themselves. So, you know, being too transactional, you step away from really understanding or being purpose-driven. So there are two ways, obviously, being, you know, a business or business leader. Transactional is very commoditized. Purpose-driven is all about, you know, really driving quality product.
Mm. Mm. Okay. So, yeah, continue on the story of
that. So contact group, great premise, really bought into the people. Slight fly in the ointment was it was recession 2. I think that was around 2008-ish. And we were doing well. A couple of agencies went down. Composition of that group changed.
So you'd sold to this group at this point?
Yeah, so we're rolling up.
Yeah. How did you feel when you sold the company? What a great achievement.
Yes. And you know why I'm hesitating there, but
genuinely at the when it was done at the beginning of selling it, how did you feel before we
started? Oh, fantastic! Because you know we set ourselves a goal to join this group where we're stronger together, we're getting more value together, the good people, all that kind of stuff, and it makes perfect sense. And
you make some money surely through it as well.
Made some money, made some money. So how that works, you know. Yes, so made some money. So that was good, all good. But then, you know, because of the composition change in that structure of that business, you know, and how that group then wanted to morph into not being a, you know, necessarily a boutique network. It wanted to become more of a sports marketing business, which made absolute sense because a lot of the, you know, the commercial value was there, but that. Then to get to where, you know, the point is in this particular pivot was it wasn't what I wanted.
Set the scene for us because you've sold your company, you're still running it, obviously. You've got some money in the bank now. You're on holiday. You're in Corfu. Sun is shining. You've got a child by this point, or your wife's pregnant?
Wife's pregnant.
You know, come on, living the dream. You've exited, but you're running a company that you love. You're on holiday, everything's good. But how are you feeling inside?
So we'd just been married, short space of time, just bought a house, done it up. And, you know, no, on a small level. And we were in our favourite place in Corfu. Yeah, modest place, but you know, love Corfu, and I'm in the pool. I look around to my new wife, pregnant, and I realised I wasn't very happy. You know, I had all this amazing stuff, all these things that were making me so happy on one side of things, but I knew that I wasn't happy on my work side of things, and you know, had a bit of a moment, penny drop moment, when. And it was fueled by seeing my wife pregnant and thinking, I don't want to be a miserable dad. And I'm quite a basic human being. You know, I just know I like to bounce out of bed, be driven on what I think is right, and then crack into that. And then, you know, when things aren't right, they surface pretty quickly. They unsettle me.
How would you feel at that time when you woke up out of bed for ready for work that day?
Just sluggish, you know.
What are the thoughts going on? What's the inner chatter going on in your head?
Just going through the motions, you know, not thinking the agency's going in the right direction. You know, the fundamental drivers behind feelings that we get to in a second were, you know, we'd gone from, and you know, this is a stating the obvious, you go from running the business, being totally in control of the business, whatever happens with that business, you know, away from delivering what you've contracted to for your clients, you have obviously full control of. When you sell your business, you do not. You know, you have a voice on a board, but, you know, it might be a minority one. So, you know, you're not in control anymore, obviously.
I guess you're not thinking about that when you sell. No. You're just thinking, this is great. You know, we get all these benefits.
Exactly. So, again, setting your targets, sometimes you've got to, you know, see round and think round, you know, what a particular target is. And you get to, you know, a junction in life, and then you then live it. And then, you know, if there's a disjoint there, it's very difficult for, you know, someone like me, because I don't deal with it very well. You know, I just want to do what I think is the best thing to do for me and the business.
And you love as well.
Exactly. I mean, that's it. It's what you love. And I can't just be in the hamster wheel, just cracking on. That's not me.
So what did you say to your wife on that holiday? Do you remember?
So I had the revelation in my own mind that, you know, I wasn't happy. And I said, you know, I said to her, look, this is not ideal, but, you know, I don't think I fit there. So I need change. And, you know, the background to that is, you know, the composition of that business was changing. It was, you know, they were scaling to then go into an event, which is cool, but that meant profit before people. Where our business would go, be more department rather than standalone specialist agency. That didn't sit well at all with me. I didn't think it was right for our clients. I thought we'd lose our competitive edge. And so, you know, something needed to be done. And all these things were in my head. You know, I'd had all these other life events going on as well, but I just knew I had the potential to be that miserable father. Maybe I'm there now. But but at that point in time, so I don't want that. You know, this is going to be a huge event, you know, with a child coming in. I want to be positive of mindset, not negative of mindset. So Alice was amazing. My wife. So she's been amazing twice. You know, when I have had these counterintuitive conversations, and then she's very much been just go and do what you need to do, which is fantastic.
Even more so, because you're saying basically you want to stop doing this thing that's bringing in money and everything, and you've got a child on the way, and you want to take a risky move. What are you suggesting to her that you do?
At this point, I didn't quite know, and that crystallized quite quickly after the holiday. At this point, I said, "Look, I'm not happy. I think I need a move." I don't know how that looks yet, but this isn't working for me. And so she was hugely supportive of that. So it's more emotional than actually working it out practically at this point. And then I came back, had a beer with my partner.
Well, of course, you've got a business partner. Yeah. So he could be having a great time and you've got to go and tell him, sorry, mate, I'm not actually enjoying this. That must have been a bit nerve-wracking to have that conversation.
Yes and no. He's lovely. You know, we have a great relationship, very honest, transparent relationship. So you tend not to see too much from, you know, not a lot comes from left field. But so I went back and dropped this and said, mate, this is not cool, in, you know, for me at the moment. And he said, funny you should say that. I'm in exactly the same place.
He was feeling the same.
Yeah, so that was reassuring. And out of that, you know, we, you know, became the genesis of Amigo Partnership and what that represents. So we exited there.
Hold on a minute. How do you handle that? Because you've got people that you've said, look, yeah, we're selling to you. we're in this for the long term, probably, I guess you said that, and this is how we're going. How do you handle such a difficult conversation?
Well, it was difficult and it wasn't straightforward. And, you know, it wasn't difficult. It was difficult. So, again, you've got kind of a number of layers, haven't you? So first layer is people. So the business, the environment the business was in was a good environment. So there was no kind of guilt around exiting because they had decent management structure and all that kind of stuff. They're doing it, as in, how do you exit? Far more difficult. That's for another podcast. And then, we did a lot of gardening for a while. And then, you know, in that time...
How long did you have to... Is this gardening league?
Yeah, I think it was about 9 months.
Oh,
that's a fair time of reflection.
Yeah, fair time of reflection.
Garden must have been pretty good after that.
It's only a small one. But lots of paint a house from top to bottom, though. It was interesting times. Yeah, a lot of, reflection, introspection. Also brilliant to clear the cache of the mind and go again, particularly around the time of having a child.
So interesting you say that, because we another episode we had was with James Denton Clark, who's now CEO of Saatchi & Saatchi. He had 6 months of gardening leave. It's the exact same thing he said. Cache in the mind got cleared. So it's quite interesting to hear you both say that, and sounds like it's really what it does do for you to take that time off.
Yeah, it was great. I mean, I'm going to contradict myself now. It was concerning because you've come out of a secure, from a monetary perspective, environment. You know how it works because you put it together. You know, you're familiar with the people, familiar with the processes, etc. And then you're painting a room, thinking about next with no financial security. But it was great for... You've got an identity issue at this point as well, because you've just exited this, you know, your baby, handed it over in a way that you then realise, I quite love that, but I wanted it doing that, you know.
Any advice for anybody who's going through something similar? They maybe have sold the company or they have to go on gardening leave. Looking back, was there anything you'd do differently or anything you did that worked well?
I think I'd probably be a little bit more articulate with the group company about, I'll share my feelings earlier rather than bottle them. And then, because I had so much going on in my personal life as well, I probably could have long viewed them with people, and maybe that would have added, you know, that would have created layers of reassurance or whatnot. But ultimately, I don't think it would have changed the outcome. So, and also sometimes you need to keep your cards quite close to your chest for legal reasons. Yeah, I mean, I think, again, the advice around that is, you know, if people are going through it now, is just do it eyes wide open, in that, you know, it is obvious. But when you sell your business, that business is not yours anymore. That, you know, you will go through a possibly an earn out. You need to understand within that earn out that, you know, you are now part of a bigger machine. You know, so you're not going to be potentially the decision maker. You know, you might be, you know, in a wider, you know, most likely group board scenario where you're just one voice or two voices, as Paul himself, you know, whatnot. But that process was great, in that I did have time away, I did clear the cash, and that was a mental reset, which was really good. It provided clarity around taking the, you know, what we knew was wrong, you know, where we were and what we wanted to achieve next, which was Amigo Partnership. And the philosophy about that was all about being client first, people first. So
is this, you did what you did before you started your first company, which is called Kodu?
Kodu Digital, yeah.
Kodu Digital. Where you set out, okay, for this new company, this is our vision, this is our philosophy, this is what makes us unique. You went through your same process, I guess.
Yes, I mean, there's a morph from Rainmaker into Kodu Digital, and then that's kind of, doesn't matter. The way we went with Amigo Partnership was very much around, you know, what is the purpose of it? And, you know, the purpose was all, you know, about being people and client first. It was about, you know,
as opposed to what?
Well, you can be very, as I say, you know, previously you can be quite transactional or you can be purpose driven. So we wanted to be a more purpose driven agency, and that's all about, you know, building culture, building teams, etc., putting the purpose and the product at the forefront. You've got to do that, I think, to be successful anyway, to find that gap in the market, to find that differentiating point. You can't be a transactional, you know, me too, because in that space, it's a cost thing, you know, et cetera, rather than, yeah, it's cost and quality, but it's not purpose and differentiation. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does, yeah.
So that was cool. So, you know, Amigo, in the kind of formative kind of point around the brand, Amigo means friend, partnerships mean, you know, means collaboration. So a friend, the premise behind it was a friend will always go the extra mile for you, client first. Friend will also occasionally have to say, you don't want to hear this, but. So it's having that counsel. And then a partnership is all about how do you work together, share your experience. Mm-hmm. You know, the three of us here, you guys have experience that I don't have, I'll have experience you don't have, but if we can put that together, then we're better for it. Mm. So that's the premise behind, you know, the brand as we started it. It has morphed into, you know, other things that we'll talk about later, but that's what that was the foundational philosophy behind the business.
You set up this new agency, and at one point you get a call from a previous client talking to you about a pitch that you'd done months before. Share a little bit about what happened next with us.
Yeah, I mean, this is a amazing piece of kind of history to the business, but also just very fortuitous in that, you know, previously we'd gone and pitched for big piece of work for Jabra, who are a Danish brand. At this point in time, they were like heavily into Bluetooth, I think number one Bluetooth manufacturer, but generally for kind of car kits and workplace stuff. But they were pivoting into a lifestyle product set in, you know, stereo earphones and, you know, either buds or over the ear. And so previously we'd you know, at Kodu, we'd pitch for this work, and the marketing director, it's good, you know, we'd worked together years ago on one-to-one T-Mobile. Mm-hmm. We were close, going back to networking, keeping up, you know, all that kind of stuff. Good friends now and whatnot, as in peers. We'd keep in touch, share information, help. Anyway, so she was marketing director when we pitched them, I guess, 12 months previous. It was a long amount of time, definitely over the 9-month garden leave and all that legal stuff. And anyway, she calls and says, good, it's been a while. Good news. You've won this pitch. Do you remember that way back when? So, that is good news. However, we don't work there anymore. we've just set up this like startup agency called Amigo Partnership, and totally understand if it goes elsewhere. Sorry about this, and you know, this news. And so Suzanne was amazing. She said, "Look, can you do it? Yes, we can. So yeah, we've got this. You know, we." Put all the strategy and the ideas together for the pitch, whatnot, that we're capable of doing. And then we just need to scale the business, get the right teams in, da 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 da, easy, you know, that's fine. And so she took a bit of a leap of faith for getting us in, and we won that work. So
amazing.
It was an amazing piece of work, because it was a really nice, meaty, you know, big, beautiful case study, because it was launching their stereo product range globally. So we came up with the creative platform idea, so all the messaging that sat behind it, et cetera, the visual, you know, identity of it, you know, all the global advertising, digital assets, retail assets, whatever assets, toolkit. So yeah, amazing piece of work. And we did a variety of other things as well, you know, for Jabra, which is great, you know, influencer space or whatnot. So that was amazing, because that gave us a really good, you know, sizable piece of business to then foundation, you know, grow, you know, in terms of teams, create more of a long view, Did dip off a bit though. Should have gone up like that because we were too into it. And then we had a tangible reference point on how our agency does work. Mm-hmm. We've done this and it's good. So that was great because then you can kick the doors in with that and show what we've just done, and it's a sizable, impressive piece of work. So that was amazing.
It's a bit difficult. I'm trying to think how, you know, people can use that model because it's we're into a sort of a certain area. Is there any advice you can share on that, going from working at a big agency to going out alone and getting that first client? Are there ways to do it that it'll work well?
It's not easy. Again, there's a couple of factors, I guess, that, you know, depend on how long you've been working in the industry. You know, the longer you work in the industry, the more contacts you have. Mm. You know who what makes them tick, what they need, et cetera, et cetera. And then you obviously give them a point of view and help them, you know, in their challenges, their ambition, deliver against their ambitions, et cetera. Away from that, in terms of new business development, you know, what we find works is to go low volume, high value. So what I mean by that is, you know, just don't scattergun and spam everybody. You know, just understand a brand or business for what it is. Have a point of view on why you think, you know, they could do better in a certain channel or whatever, and then give them that point of view. You know, and also give them insight. So it's fine having having a subjective point of view, because anybody can do that. But if you deliver insight and validate and evidence why, you know, you think you can move from X to Y, that's the way to have the conversation. That's what we do. So, you know, as a business, we're all about, you know, evidencing and delivering insight.
Okay, got it. So yeah, you go on this journey to growing your company that you're still running today, Amigo Partnerships, going very well. And you break through a milestone, I think, is a ceiling for a lot of business owners. And we've got a couple of questions on that.
So first, describe, what is the issue with getting above the £1 million turnover?
It seems to be a ceiling in the agency kind of world, where breaking through that 1 million is quite a difficult thing.
And I'm sure most industries have that number, whatever it is. It might be a different number for a different industry, but there'll be a certain ceiling that just businesses tend to hit as they're sort of starting out.
Exactly. And a lot of it comes down to, you know, the overhead you're carrying, how comfortable you are. You know, it's obviously easier to manage a lower overhead, right? And fewer jobs. But then you need, you know, processes and systems that can scale through, and you need to be delivering from a performance basis the right amount of margin, therefore profit, that can be reinvested into talent or systems, etc., to then be able to kick through it. You need to be building those pipelines, having the visibility, etc., and it's all managing, you know, overhead with ability to generate more revenue, service more revenue, because obviously the, you know, headcount is a factor of being able to service revenue. If you've got less people, you have to, you know, you can have a load of kind of ninjas and you have a higher gross profit per head output, but there are certain kind of ceilings around that as well, depending on your business model type. So it's just getting those fine balances and being able to have the right amount of opportunity, so pipeline throughput to then layer on, servicing your clients that you've established well, so they're retained, but you're driving organic revenue growth through them as well by proving that you're good, delivering results, and then being value additive and extending out potentially into different service areas that are complementary to what you're doing and native to your service delivery.
And these are ways to break through this barrier, are they?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And also it's sometimes being kind of brave around going for higher value client, for higher value work. So that, you know, this similar amount of effort goes into a small budget that it does into a big budget, for instance, you know, in a kind of simplified manner. So again, it's about where you put your effort as well, and then you try and get more upstream and do the bigger jobs that have the bigger revenue number that then you can build your teams around. But you know, making sure that you are cognizant of margin and always defending your margin, because that buffer delivers profit, but it, you know, but as you're scaling, delivers you the ability to then invest in talent, invest in systems, invest in different things that you need to be able to scale.
I like that. Okay. And so you break through the million turnover, and what's the journey next on the Emigo partnership story?
So we now are just under 30 people, doing some amazing work with amazing clients. You know, we've got, you know, one of the, coming out of COVID, it was a bummer for everybody. We had, you know, there's another pivot around, you know, reflection and, you know, what we need to do to kind of reignite the business. And at that point, it was very much around, you know, building a new management team. So we've got an amazing management team in place, 6 people, highly capable, energetic, knowledgeable, cohesive. So that was the first bit. So then, you know,
how do you, if I'm listening to this and I'm thinking, new management team, sounds, based on everything you've shared as well, sounds like that would be a smart thing to do. What was your process? How did you approach it? How did you decide which roles we need, which ones we don't need, and who to get for them, and what they need to show?
The first area was actually, again, you don't want to go down the COVID rabbit hole, but a bit of reflection and realizing, actually, what are we good at? What are we bad at?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then, you know, building, you know, senior structure around what we're bad at. You know, so get
what
people.
What was that?
Again, we talk about, you know, kind of, you have your self-critical mass, and you know, you're good at certain, one is good at certain tasks, and over time you realize that you're either not passionate about it or actually pretty bad at it, and then so filling those talent gaps, or you know, is critical to get a cohesive team. You know, this is self-reflection, but the taking a bit of a more of a step back and being challenged and just going, actually, and this is important. Actually, it's not a recent thing, but it's a previous thing. But I think it's a really important thing for any leader in a business sense, is to go, you don't have all the answers. You can't. So don't think you can. Be comfortable with that. And then surround yourself with people that can have the answers. And then you build the answer together, you know, and then to empower, step away and empower and be a stronger team together. And that's what we're all about now. So, you know, we've got great talent, not just leadership team, brilliant talent. So it's all about now, the last journey for the last 2 years coming out of COVID is about creating, repurposing ourselves, and being really proud about our work. Coming out of kind of COVID was quite transactional because you're trying to keep the lights on, then you go, well, that doesn't work. Let's reignite it, change it all up, go again on a different, you know, kind of path, and bring everybody, actually everybody contributes and everyone goes together, and be really proud of that. And now we're at another pivot point, but now, you know, when I was talking about that, it's, you know, just putting an environment in place where, you know, you've got diversity of people, whether that be on a age level, whether that be on a cultural level, but everybody is empowered to have an opinion. I mean, everybody has an opinion, right? But listen to, you know, and can contribute to a change of idea, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So for us, that is the most important thing, to have a business where contribution is recognized, or listened to, recognized, rewarded and celebrated. And without sounding too twee, I think we're doing the best work, or, you know, I'm in an environment now where we're doing the best work we've ever done. which is great. It's down to them, not me. So yeah, it's exciting times, and you know where we go next. There's, you know, again, we're in a position of flux again, ever changing. But I think that's really important as a business and an individual. You know, we've got the advent of the fourth industrial revolution, you know, with AI, and you know that you can do, you know, a number of things with that. You can wait and see if you know if, you know what happens. You know, but we've got a point of view that it's going to have a, you know, a profound in terms of positive effect on the creative industry. So we're now all
let's
about...
Let's dive into that, because I want to go back to where this moment changed, because this is the sort of next section of this, which is a topic everybody is talking about.
Yeah.
And we haven't actually talked about much on this show. And you have made the decision really to integrate AI in a big way into your company. Not just download a new tool somewhere, or it's a big shift. Go back to where this began, this idea to do this, or inciting incident.
So last year, as a business, you know, we would be talking about AI, doing workshops, etc. We have cool shit sessions in here. We did quite a bit, you know, around AI. Personally, I went on a course that was amazing, Goldman Sachs 10K SB course at University of Oxford Said Business School.
What does that mean, 10K SB course?
It's a course that's developed for small businesses. So that is, the qualifying is you've got to be over 3 years old, under 15 million revenue, and it is to work with businesses that have the ability to scale and therefore can contribute to economic growth, etc. So that's why Goldman do it. You do it at Side Business School, so you've got amazing academic plus real growth, you know, people that have been there, done it, entrepreneurs that have, you know, scale businesses. And we had the opportunity to, you know, you go through this process where you put together a growth plan. That's the output of it, that then takes your business to the you know, where to next. And it was really good because, again, you know, when you're building a business, running a business, it's organic. You might not. There's so many different important pillars that should be in place, you know, with a business. But you might go, wow, that'll do. That's important. And it's all about getting the right, you know, kind of graphic equalizer to the right level, if you like, show me age. And that gave us going through that process gave us an opportunity, or gave me the opportunity, to go understand, you know, what are the big forces out there in terms of going to impact markets. So to me, in that process, I had a very clear penny drop moment. Again, this is the opinion of one, that AI is going to have a profound effect on our business. Yeah. Why? Because they're going to be, you know, tech emergence, you know, from a creative perspective that will have a different point of view, maybe be more competitive. You've got how we need to think about the structure and organization of our business in a new era. You've got then the point of view of, you know, what do clients need? And then in this market, well, where we are now, you know, in obviously the world of uncertainty and all this kind of stuff, and economic, whether it be economic, political, environmental, etc., uncertainty, you know, CMOs are under the hammer, you know, around delivering efficiency, effectiveness, and return on investment whilst trying to scale their brands, sales, or whatever it may be, depending on what their objectives are. But so what we, you know, the output of that, or the kind of the idea that came, what stimulated that, the course stimulated basically a pivot for us to go, right, AI is here. It's not necessarily washed through right now. It hasn't washed through the industry right now. Is it an opportunity? Is it a threat? What are we going to do about it? And so we decided to kind of face into that headwind and go, right, actually, we see this as a massive opportunity because we are, and be really clear, you know, we are not a tech business. We will never be a tech business. But what we can do is we can use AI to supercharge our process. So we talk about having an augmented creativity process. So what does that mean? It means fusing, carefully choreographing human talent, intuition, curiosity, everything that's human, craft, with AI. And what AI does, it enables you to speed up process, get a richness of information that can fuel the creative process. So we go through three areas. We've got the think phase, which is a strategy phase. So we're using a cluster of AI tools now, building our own GPT model that pulls in the information we need to deliver strategy output, whether it be audience personas, market dynamics information, et cetera, very quickly. So we'd be able to get the inputs that we need to inform the create phase, which is the creative, the ideation phase, you know, in minutes, hours, rather than weeks or days, weeks. Mm-hmm. So it just speeds up that process. We're also, as a business, I mean, there's a big move in the market as well around, you know, in terms of the traditional commercial agency model going from time and resource or time and materials, excuse me, into being more around a kind of consultancy model and a productization model. So we're pivoting both together at the same time because that's what clients kind of expect, and it's more value based. It's not, you know, you're still delivering a service, but the premise of that service delivery, we will deliver this for you, is we will actually create, we're going to bring benefit to you and value to you. And that's, you know, that's the vector we're on. But going back to it, so augmented creativity is about the careful choreographing of humans and AI. We're a human business. The human is a hero. What does that do? Say it delivers benefit. So it delivers speed from a client perspective. It delivers speed. It delivers efficiencies. It delivers effectiveness. For internally, what does it do? The benefit is time. So, you know, our humans, our specialists have more headspace to be more value additive for our clients. So it reduces some of that kind of mandrolic process stuff that you've got to do to be to deliver good service to the clients. But that can be kind of machine led. Obviously, then you interpret it. You need a human interface there to understand, depending on what it is, but if it's in a creative sense, bias, to make sure it's right, et cetera, but it enables us to, basically pivot to be what we call intelligent progress. So, and that's all about, the intelligence comes from, you know, the fusion of amazing talent, people, capability, craft, experience, curiosity, empathy, et cetera, with progress, which is how we do it more efficiently, deliver, you know, effectiveness and return on investment, growth, whatever that may be, but we will deliver progress through this engine.
So it's a real blend of human intelligence and artificial intelligence. That's what your company is doing now.
It's understanding, you know, through that creative delivery process, what's important. Yeah, this we had a process called the evidence-based creativity, and what that does, it's our proprietary process, but you know, any good agency will go through a similar thing where you start with interrogation of a client brief. You then look at the world, what we do anyway, through three lenses. So what you're trying to do is get audience insight to connect a brand and a brand truth with an audience. So, you know, for us, we look at market dynamics. So, you know, how a client what's the competitive advantage within that market for the client? The reasons to believe and the truths? Where can they play in the white space to be as differentiated or more competitive? Then we look at the audience. So we use a lot of data and insights tool to then go, right, do you really understand your audience? Build personas, understand, you know, psychographics, behavior, points of influence, media alignment, brand alignment, understand that, you know, the psychographics as well, you know, will inform tone of voice, et cetera, et cetera. Then we want to look at the kind of landscape sits behind both of those things. So that is the kind of change landscape. So what is happening environmentally, politically, economically, culturally, that will drive, you know, what should inform that, you know, a creative connect with a brand. You know, and we're living, as say, in a world of turmoil at the moment, uncertainty. So we're worried about cost of living, we're worried about, you know, safety, you know, we're living about, worried about lots of different things. So, but they inform, you know, what we then do from a creative perspective. Mm. Now we've, you know, what we're doing now, or we're using different AI tools to output that information, but actually now we're joining them up into clusters. So we know what we need to inform creative, and now we can reduce the time to do that.
Can you share what AI tool you're using, or is that a secret sauce?
We're using a variety of them.
Are there any, like, if I'm listening to this, I'm like, cool, you're integrating AI, I want to learn from you, I want to integrate AI into my business. Any tools you'd recommend? Any things, places to look?
Yes. So again, you what we're doing is just separating it into operations and then service delivery. Mm. So operations wise, we're using, like you're using Supernormal, for instance, you know. Mm. So contact reports used to take hours, you know, now it's look at it, mate, because the, yeah, Supernormal does get it.
Tell people on. What Supernormal is.
So Supernormal, as an example, sits on meetings, you know, on Teams or whatever, and it will transcribe the meeting. Mm. And it will then deliver meeting notes instantaneously after your meeting. It needs the human interface to go through and make sure there's accuracy in there, but it will get you, you know, hypothetically to 90%, 95% of that capturing accurately. And therefore a process in terms of a classic client service requirement of contact reporting the meeting can be done far faster. And therefore that client service representative who's been paid by the hour for the client on a project, it can now pivot their time to be more value additive. Mm. And that's, and a perfect example, actually, of how you can integrate certain AI tools into certain systems and functions. So what we did is broke down what we do as an agency, operationally, systems, functions, found an AI tool for that, because there is an AI tool for that, and then we've built our own kind of AI tech stack. This is on an ops level, and then kind of integrated them as much as possible. So that kind of process and service delivery point of view from a business is, we're trying to reduce, you know, the human burden as much as we can there on a service level basis.
And does, just stop there, does it actually work, or do you find yourself going,
oh, it's not quite right?
Quicker to just do it ourselves. Yeah. You know, we're just trying to tweak it and get it to work. How have you found that process?
We haven't had, I don't think, this might just be my little bubble. I think it's been really positive. You know, it's been great. I mean, you've got to, there's always a little teething phase to go through. But yeah, it's worth it. There's, you know, so many different, I mean, you just talked about one thing that's the bane of client service people's lives, contact reporting. Done. I'm reading it rather than writing it. I'm slightly modifying it. Might add a little bit of value into it as well. But bang, there you go, job done, thank you very much. Onto something that's...
onto something else that can add more value, right?
Exactly, be more productive. So, yeah, if you break it down like that, as I say, what we've done is we've broken our systems and processes and look where it will be, for us, value additive. Mm. And then on the service level, it's about, you know, again, we are... AI is available to everybody. So what we're doing on the service level in terms of creating our, you know, AI-ing our augmented creativity flow isn't necessarily new unique, because you'll get creatives using Mid Journeys, your Fireflies, etc., etc., your ChatGPTs to, you know, look, develop mood boards, develop concepting. We've used AI for a long time for creative effectiveness testing, so where you test on a piece of creative cognitive demand and clarity, so we know it's you know it's going to work pre going into market. So you know that's not particularly unique, but what we think's unique about the way we're doing it is we're daisy chaining it. So we're going from from strategy into concept and creative, and then into implementation, and then linking everything up. So it's all, again, using value additive a lot, but it's creating it all through that data chain.
Yeah, data driven.
How? Yeah, how are we doing that?
Linking it all up.
So we're creating a GPT that sits above other tools, and everything's about prompting, right? So then it just calls in the information that we need to then output at each point of the process the materials we do need. So in one area, in the strategy phase, we need audience information. So we need personas and insight. We can call that in, asking the right questions to the right AI tool and or data and insights tool that has an AI API, to then call in what we need and then just go with it.
I see.
Takes the research out. Well, it takes the time
to do that.
You're utilizing ChatGPT to build those personas, for example, rather than based on real data that's out there, rather than having to go and do that research yourself.
Yes and no. So we are using a GPT to then speak to different AI tools, and then surface that information through these tools or data and insights providers, and surface that information how we want it. Yeah, that's one part of it. And then we are embedding within in business as well, the likes of what we just talked about, using the Midjourney, Fireflies, et cetera, to then be able to do rapid mood boarding, rapid concept testing, et cetera, et cetera. Rapid creative benchmarking. And it takes, they're all things that are fundamental to delivering whatever it is you're delivering as, and it could be creative or it could be strategy. They are inherently time consuming. So if you can speed that process up, and you don't want to obviously cannibalize your cost base, because that's not what we're doing. But if you can free your creative teams up to have more thinking time, challenge it more, craft it more, that's where the value comes.
Yeah. I always see it kind of like what Google did to the Yellow Pages.
Yeah, perfect.
Right,
yeah,
exactly. It's just a slightly different world we're in now, where we're able to generate and retrieve information at such a speed and at in such specifics that it can free us up.
That's the perfect example, actually, because it's just about surfacing information in a convenient way, in an intuitive and better way.
Yeah, and it kind of shows where we're going. I sit there with my two daughters, 6 and 3. I had ChatGPT-4 open. I was like, "What do you want to do, girls?" They're like, "What do you mean?" I was like, "Should we make a poem? Should we make a picture?" Naturally, they wanted to do a unicorn. Okay, a unicorn. Oh, it's a bit too cartoony. Should we make it real? Yeah, we made it real. Jumping over a rainbow. They loved it. And it's just like, this is where we're at now. It can be fun, it can be helpful. As long as you plug it into what you're doing, it can save you time and will save you time and keep you at the cutting edge of where we are. Yeah. I really do feel like it is evolve or be extinct is always quite a harsh phrase, but it does feel like that if you've got some people that will be doing prompts that save them 2 hours of work a day, and you've got other people that are manually going through books or web pages, copying, pasting, there's definitely an advantage to the prompting way of doing it.
100%. And yeah, perfect examples as well. Where our point of view, this is where the human's so important, is because of the interpretation of that information and then what you do with it. So, our point of view is you cannot write or deliver brand creative through a prompt yet, because the most important thing about what we do or any creative agency should be doing is creating a meaningful emotional connection between the brand and the target audience. What comes out is quite functional, you know, generally speaking. So it's down to the specialist to be able to go, right, that's going to get me to there faster, which delivers value to our client, whether that be speed, your speed to market, you know, efficiencies, etc. And then put layer the craft on.
If I'm listening to this and I might be running a business, or I might be a business leader, and I'm thinking AI is dangerous, and I'm scared of what it will do to our industry, whatever industry that would be. What would you say to them?
That's a big question. There are so, right, macro world, irrespective of the subject matter of, you know, a creative industry, business, agency, whatever, is that, yeah, I think there's a real kind of concern, because you've got, you know, the kind of concern about job markets, and what's the effect on, you know, on certain job types, and that's absolutely valid. You've got the concern around bias in AI. I'm doing at the moment another course through Cyber Business School, which is the University of Oxford AI program, and it's fascinating. And the module we're on right now actually is around bias in machine learning. And bias can come from who's training the machine. So, you know, that's going to come from education, culture, socioeconomic group, da-da-da-da-da. So if you have bias when you're training a tool, that's going to be come through it. If you've got bias data, that's going to come through it. The machine is stupid. You know, it's not, because it's going to obviously learn, but it is a machine. It doesn't have, you know, the degrees of empathy that the human being would, and understand cultural nuance unless it's trained. So you've got unconscious bias that just talked about. You've got conscious bias, and you've got intended, you know, malicious activity where you could be training tools up and it's kicking out fake news and stuff like that. So there is a, that will obviously cause issues in society, could cause, you know, this is dramatic, you know, rewrite certain history facts, but you know what, that is information, we all believe it. So, you know, that could be really concerning. So, I mean, there will, but hence for policy and this, you know, and government to be able to, you know, make sure that, you know, the ethics of AI are good.
Is AI going to take over? Do you think there is a possibility that, and we should be concerned and aware of that, we could get ourselves in a position longer term where we no longer have the power over AI that we do now, and it starts to have the power over us?
That's a really difficult question to ask. So, and you know, I'm reading a book, I can't remember the guy's name now, he's out of Google, but it's called Scary Smart, and read it, it's really interesting. I'm not far enough into it to form my own conclusions yet, but there is a, you know, that there's truth in some of the fear, you know, that you talk about. I hope, as a, you know, a global population, that we will, you know, act in a way that you know, that makes the possibility of AI really powerful. Again, taking a step back to take a step forward, my personal belief is, and this is why we're doing what we're doing, when you're faced with a kind of comparison like, this is the fourth industrial revolution, you go, and then GPT being general purpose technology, so a general purpose technology was electricity, you know, back in whatever, industrial revolution two or whatever, might have got that wrong, but it's one of them, I think it's two. And then you go, right, how do you see the adoption of electricity and what that, the profound effect that it's had on society? So you had, you know, profound effect on business, profound effect on, you know, business industry, and profound effect, obviously, on society. And you know, to be a GPT, it has to be pervasive, it has to be deliver economic growth, etc. And then, you know, you're looking at AI as a GPT, general purpose technology, that will be pervasive because it kind of already is. You're talking about it, you know, doing stuff with your kids, which is fantastic. And it, you know, and it's perceived to be delivering economic growth. Great. And if you know what the correlation between economic growth and life expectancy is, more economic growth, live longer, better health. So if you look at it on that lens, then you go, well, you know, the possibilities are really positive. So I break it into that on a macro level. On a micro level for us, you know, talks about it. It's delivering benefit for us as a business that we can then tangibly deliver benefit for our clients. So at this stage, you know, I think it's a positive thing, but needs to be treated with respect on a kind of more macro and, you know, where stuff goes with media content, et cetera, issues we have anyway.
Mm. I saw yesterday with the tech that's able to turn a photo into either a video or like a lip sync. You can make a photo just kind of talk now and all that kind of stuff, which is...
I think it's Alibaba.
And I think Sora can do it as well. Cool,
yeah,
but also very dangerous because we may get to a point where you're not too sure what's real and what's not.
Oh, we're already there, I think, sometimes.
Deep fake.
To a degree, yeah. Deep fakes and stuff like that, which proposes just general issues in ways because if you don't know what's real, then you could fall for anything.
Don't you? You're absolutely right. And that is a concern, isn't it? So, you know, the policing of it, regulation around it needs to be really tight. You know, it's going to have an effect on, as you say, you know, media consumption, what you believe, what is real fact, what is real history, what is real what is a real person. Mm-hmm. You know, you see the, I forget what the name is, something AI, the Instagram bot that has a tremendous amount of followers and, you know, making like loads of money on Insta. It's an AI, you know, so yeah. We're going to have different filters on ourselves to then, you know, that we need to go through before we start believing stuff. But then you go, actually, credible sources of, you know, more power to good media, you know. So then, you know, broadcasters, content producers, et cetera, you know, there's a possibility that they become way more relevant. They're very relevant anyway. But, you know, because they are sources of credibility that put the checks and balances in, and then maybe that's the way you go, hang on, before I believe that, let's reference it over here. Mm. You know, so, yeah, but we've got to stop and think.
Yeah, I think it is how you look at it, you know, and it is helpful to view it as in an optimistic, positive manner that it can do great things. And you do look back in history and you do see there are other times where this happened, where, you know, electricity came along and everybody was scared of that. And, oh my gosh, it's going to do this or that. And so it seems hard to judge at this point whether we're just in that phase now and it'll just be normal and fine in the future. Or if do we need to be really concerned and put really strict measures in now. There's no right answer, I don't think. But it's good to be having the conversation is, I think, the important thing, isn't it?
100%. And it's, you talk about electricity, you know, the kind of danger of electricity is fire, electrocution. You know, it can have profound effect on human life. So, again, but regulation, normalisation, you know, we live in a world now where we go, what do you mean? It's a general purpose technology. It's just there. You know, so could AI become that? It's just Google on steroids, isn't it, really? You know, so I know that's really dumbing it down, but it is, you know, served up data in a particular way that is more actionable, more rich. You know, going back to the course I was doing last year, which was, again, you know, pivotal in terms of understanding for me, you know, where we now see the positive benefit of AI. There's a guy on this course that did similar things with his children. He'd write me a story with my daughter in it, you know, that's set in whatever, you know. It's like, and then you'd read that story to them at bedtime, and it's like, that's great.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I know where we are, we think it's a world of possibility. It can, and I'm banging on, but it can help you put efficiencies into your business. It can help deliver content richness. It can deliver, it can be educational. It can deliver, it can be fantastic for concepting and looking at the art of the possible before going to production and whatnot. I think it's very rich.
It can make unicorns.
It can make unicorns.
Exactly. So you've mentioned it there. I think we want to end on a very human point, which is what this podcast is a lot about, is the human side of life.
So one of the final questions of today is, how do you approach supporting your children so that they can live the life that's best for them?
I like to think that, you know, trying to create a kind of domestic culture, just to let them do what they want to do, empower them to be who they want to be, and, you know, give them the possibility to dream, that anything's possible, you know, so just be who, you know, be a good person, do the right things, think big. Mm. Yeah, and follow your dreams, you know. So if you're passionate about things, I think two things happen there. One, you'll be fulfilled, and I think it's hugely important. Doesn't matter what you do, be fulfilled. And the other one is, if you're passionate about what you do, you tend to do it better, and then you tend to be more successful. Mm. So it's finding that. I think, you know, as a father, and you know, yeah, enabling them to find it is, you know, be the people they want to be, as long as they're kind, as long as they think big, they'll be all right.
What are your kids' names?
Sam and Tom.
Sam and Tom. There you go. There's the message, Sam and Tom. And are you proud of Sam and Tom?
I'm very proud of Sam and Tom. Don't tell them all the time, but particularly when they're leaving stuff all over the house. But no, I'm very proud of Sam and Tom. I mean, they are, you know, they're amazing kids, and you know, they keep myself and my wife on our toes all the time, and they surprise us all the time, and they see the world in a different way, which is amazing, and so it can be quite enlightening as well. I just wish they'd not leave their clothes around the house.
And so after they've tied their clothes away, what are you proud of about them?
I'm proud of so many things. So I'm proud of them just for being who they are. You know, they.
How old are they? Just to give context.
They're 12 and 10. Mm-hmm. So Sam, for instance, has just gone to secondary school, and so that kind of change is. Because obviously you live fears, right, as a parent, and you know, you have this different level of consciousness. Now they're your biggest point of vulnerability. And then you've got to, like taking leaps of faith in business, you've got to let them just crack on and be who they want to be and define their own identity and try not to suppress it. And, you know, daydreaming is good. You know, daydreaming can be a little bit annoying sometimes when you've got to go get a train, mate. But you know, daydreams when they're forming their own creative thought processes, and so you can't suppress creativity, you know, da da da. But yeah, so Sam's gone to secondary school. He, you know, now gets on a train to go to school. You know, he could barely navigate a door, you know, you know, in the summer, and now we've got to go, oh yes, fine, get on a train, mate. So I'm very proud of, you know, he's just gone in terms of his maturity. Youngest one, they're both dyslexic, by the way, so they've, you know, they have, again, you know, learning difficulties and systems and processes that have got to put into place for themselves, and they're excelling irrespective of that, which can be a superpower, but it's a hindrance as well.
That's what we're going to say. Yeah. Through this show we've learned what a superpower having dyslexia is. Mm. You know, it's Phil Thomas, who's CEO or was CEO of Cannes Lions, now CEO of Essential, the holding company. Zav Rees, group CEO of AMV, BBDO. They didn't realize it when they were younger, and it seemed like a hindrance then. But as they've gone through their career and are in a different time now, they can look back and go, wow, this is the thing that actually makes me unique and makes me really good at this, this, and this. And that's why I've been able to become CEO, because I'm dyslexic. So it's this great superpower. if you're given that encouragement and clarity to see what it unlocks, which is really cool.
Totally agree. I mean, for our kids, we got them. You get a review person in. I can't quite remember what the right terminology is, but anyway, they do like a review of your child's behaviours and stuff like that. And both of them are dyslexic, and which probably means I'm dyslexic, because apparently, if one of you parents is dyslexic, you've got a 50% chance that a kid's going to be dyslexic. Mm. So if you've got two dyslexic kids, probably means a wife and myself dyslexic. I can remember school, pre-diagnosis of these things, I had learning difficulties. And then what you do is you put systems and processes in place to make sure that you can keep up, be on time, do whatever. And then that's what they're going through now. You know, it is fantastic that it is understood, because people are, like, for instance, growing up, I'm very visual. So I'd need to be, can you show me what you mean, please? You know, rather, don't tell me, because I've just gone. Show me, you know. So that was my learning requirement. And I didn't know that. I didn't get it until I was older, you know. But now if you can understand that actually that's more suitable to you because of how your brain works, then you can, yeah, accept it, use it, be a superpower, but just understand who you are, which is fantastic because it's completely normalized.
Well, there we go. That is the story of how you became CEO and founder of the Amigo Partnership, and the story of Amigo Partnership, which, again, is great to hear. That journey you've been on finding that happiness once again in what you do. Now we are here for the final poem.
Set a target and follow passion. Success could be your future destination. By looking in from the outside, you can bring solutions that can surpass expectation. Networking and enabling clients, a few tips for ongoing success. The power of face-to-face meetings to keep relationships strong and fresh. Let purpose be your driver. More than small change and fivers, your actions will reflect your true vision. Even when it may seem strange, you might be called to switch lanes when the fun times have turned into a prison. What are you good at? And where are your talent gaps? Questions to be a fully bodied force. To listen, to recognize, be supported and celebrated. Values that can keep you up front with the torch.
Brilliant. Two poems in one day.
Thank you for joining us today.
Cheers. Thank you, guys.
At the start of this day, no one had ever written a poem about you.
Exactly.
And now you have two.
Two.
One for each pocket.
There you go.
Cheers, guys.
All right, thanks very much.